midnight, its abutment turned to jello, and the reservoir awoke from its deceptive slumber and tore the dam apart. There are few earthly phenomena more awesome than a flood, and there is no flood more awesome than several years' accumulation of rainfall released over the course of an hour or two. The initial surge of water was 200 feet high and could have toppled nearly anything in its path. 1,000-ton blocks of concrete rode the crest like rafts. 75 families were living in San Francisquito Canyon, immediately below the dam. Only one of their members, who managed to claw his way up the canyon wall just before the first wave hit, survived. 10 miles below, the village of Castaic Junction stood where the narrow canyon opened into the broader and flatter Santa Clara Valley. When the surge engulfed the town, it was still 78 feet high. Days later, bodies and bits of Castaic Junction showed up on the beaches near San Diego. The flood exploded into the Santa Clara River, turned right, and swept through the valley toward the ocean. It tore across a construction camp where 170 men were sleeping and carried off all but 6. A few miles below, Southern California Edison was building a project and had erected a tent city for 140 men. At first, the night watchman thought it was an avalanche. As it dawned on him that the nearest snow was 50 miles away, the flood crest hit 40 feet high. The men who survived were those who didn't have time to unzip their canvas tents, which were tight enough to float downstream like rafts. 84 others died. When the flood went through Peru, Fillmore, and Santa Paula, it was semi-solid, a battering ram congealed by homes, wagons, telephone poles, cars, and mud. Wooden bridges and buildings were instantaneously smashed to bits. A woman and her 3 children clung to a floating mattress until it snagged in the upper branches of a tree. They survived. A rancher who heard the deluge coming loaded his family in his truck and began to dash to safety. As he stopped by his neighbor's house and ran to the door to warn them, the flood arrived and swept his family out to sea. A 4-room house was dislodged and floated a mile downstream without a piece of furniture rearranged. When the dazed owners came to inspect it, they found their lamps still upright on their living room tables. A brave driver, trying to outrace the flood, could not bring himself to pass the people waving desperately along the way. His car held 14 corpses when it was hauled out of the mud. The flood went on, barely missing Satakoy and Montalvo, and at 5 o'clock in the morning, went by Ventura and spent itself at sea. Hundreds of people were dead, 1,200 homes were demolished, and the topsoil from 8,000 acres of farmland was gone. William Mulholland, whose career lay amid the ruins, was still alive, but as he addressed the coroner's inquest, he bent his head and murmured, "I envy the dead." After a feeble effort to put the blame on dynamiters, he took full responsibility for the disaster. But the great city his aqueduct had created was, for the moment at least, willing to forgive him. Chief Engineer Mulholland was a pitiable figure as he appeared before the Water and Power Commission yesterday, the Los Angeles Times reported on March 16th. His figure was bowed, his face lined with worry and suffering. Every commissioner had the deepest sympathy for the man who has spent his life for the service of the people of Los Angeles. His Irish heart is kind, tender, and sympathetic. 9 separate investigations eventually probed the collapse of the St. Francis Dam. No one is even sure how many lives were lost, but a likely total is around 450. It would become one of the dozen worst peacetime disasters in American history. The precise cause of the collapse was never officially determined, but when an investigator dropped a piece of the rock abutment into a glass of water, it dissolved in a few minutes. It was also learned that Mulholland had ordered the reservoir filled fast a violation of a cardinal engineering rule, because he didn't want Owens River water to go to waste. The city took full responsibility for all losses and paid most of the claims without contest, which cost it close to $15 million. For much less than that, Mulholland not only could have bought the Long Valley site, but built the dam, too. In the ensuing months, in hearing after hearing, Mulholland was dragged through an agonizing reappraisal of his career. It was learned that two other dams in whose design and construction he participated as a consultant eventually collapsed, and a third had to be abandoned when partially built. He was a bold engineer, an innovative engineer. He was also a reckless, arrogant, and inexcusably careless engineer. His fall from grace was slow, awful, and complete. By the time he wearily resigned, in November of 1928, at the age of 73, his reputation was sullied beyond redemption. His wit and his combativeness vanished in retirement, and even in the company of his perfervidly loyal children, he often lacked the energy to speak. He told them, "The zest for living is gone." The city finally settled with Fred Eaton, who lost almost everything in the collapse of the Waterson banks, for $650,000. A few weeks later, the two old and broken men moved to heal their 20-year rift. Lost in despondency at home, Mulholland received a message that Eaton, who had since returned to Los Angeles, would like to see him. Without a word, he got his hat and strode out the door. Eaton had suffered a stroke. He needed a cane to walk, and he looked ancient. "Hello, Fred," said Mulholland as he approached Eaton's bedside. Then both of them broke down and wept. The dam in Long Valley was ultimately built, and the reservoir that formed behind it, which was named Lake Crowley in honor of a priest who devoted the latter part of his life to healing the rift between city and valley, was in its day one of the largest in the country. By then, however, all hope of fruitful coexistence had died. On a map, the Owens Valley was still there, but it had ceased to exist as a place with its own aspirations, its own destiny. By the mid-1930s, Los Angeles was landlord of 95% of the farmland and 85% of the property in the towns. In the town of Independence, the Eastern California Museum, which tells the story of the battle largely from the valley side, sits on land leased from the city. Los Angeles leased some of the land back to farmers for a while, but the unpredictability of the water supply discouraged most of those who tried to carry on. There might be enough for 20 or 30,000 acres in wetter years, then there might be enough for only 3 or 4,000. As the city grew, the river became utterly appropriated. When that happened, the Department of Water and Power sank wells and began depauperating the aquifer, as would happen, as is happening, in so many places in the West. The last of the ranchers quit in the 1950s, and the economy shifted to tourism. Most of those who remain now pump gas, rent rooms, or serve lunch to the skiers and tourists driving through on Highway 395. By the 1970s, even that tenuous existence was threatened. The aquifer was so drawn down that desert plants which can normally survive on the meagerest capillary action of groundwater began to die. And the valley went beyond desert and took on the appearance of the Bonneville Salt Flats. When the winds of convection blow, huge clouds of alkaline dust boil off the valley floor. People now live in the Owens Valley at some risk to their health. The city has refused every request that it limit its groundwater pumping, just as it has refused to stop diverting the creeks that feed Mono Lake to the north, another casualty of its unquenchable thirst. Some sporadic dynamitings began to occur again in the 1970s, and reporters arrived, eager to cover the Second Owen Valley's war. But the war was long since over. There was nothing left to win. As for Otis Chandler Sherman and the rest of the syndicate that called itself the San Fernando Mission Land Company, they became rich. Phenomenally rich. While presiding over the San Fernando Valley's metamorphosis from desert to agricultural cornucopia, they used the profits to constantly acquire more land. In 1911, Chandler, Otis, and Sherman purchased another 47,500 acres nearby and began to develop them, the biggest subdivision in the world. Within a year, they were assembling the third largest land empire in the history of the state, the 300,000-acre Tejon Ranch, straddling Los Angeles and Kern counties. Besides the Los Angeles Times, the Tejon Ranch, undiminished in size, remains the principal local asset of the Chandler family. In a speech given in 1912, Theodore Roosevelt singled out Otis as a curious instance of the anarchy of soul which comes to a man who in conscienceless fashion deifies property at the expense of human rights. But Roosevelt, as much as anyone, was responsible for setting this anarchic soul loose. No one knows how great a profit the syndicate realized from the initial 17,000 San Fernando acres, but one writer, William Carl, estimates that Chandler was worth as much as $500 million when he died, and the San Fernando Valley was the soil from which this incredible fortune grew. It may not have been the most lucrative land scam in United States history, but it ranked somewhere near the top. Between the arrival of William Mulholland and his death, Los Angeles grew from a town of 15,000 into the then most populous desert city on Earth. Today, it is the second largest, barely surpassed by Cairo. Its obsessive search for more water, however, was never to end. While Lake Crowley was filling, the city was already completing its aqueduct to the Colorado River, whose construction almost precipitated a shooting war with Arizona, a rival as formidable as the Owens Valley was weak. And though the first Colorado River aqueduct was supposed to end its water famines forever, as was the Owens River aqueduct, the city was soon planning a second Colorado River aqueduct and plotting to seize half of the Feather River, 600 miles away, at the same time. No sooner had it managed to do all of that than the city fathers were secretly meeting with the Bureau of Reclamation, mapping diversions from rivers 1,000 miles distant in Oregon and Washington. Like the Red Queen, Los Angeles runs faster and faster to stay in place. No one says or remembers much about the Reclamation Service's involvement in the Owens Valley story, which is ironic, because nothing in its history may have affected the interest of the nation at large quite as much. Almost as soon as it was created, well before it metamorphosed into the mighty Bureau of Reclamation, the agency found itself working on behalf of the wealthy and powerful and against the interests of the constituency it was created to protect, the small western irrigation farmer. In California, to a surprising degree, it has done so ever since. Small farmers do not matter much in the worldly scheme of things. If they did, their numbers would not be declining by the tens of thousands every year. But large farmers do. And explosively growing desert cities do, too. And the Bureau of Reclamation, after learning this lesson in the Owens Valley, would remember it well. Its largest dam is San Luis in Central California. Its most magnificent dam is Hoover. Above all, the Bureau loves to build great dams, and were it not for Los Angeles, the odds are low that either Hoover or San Luis would exist. The Owens River created Los Angeles, letting a great city grow where common sense dictated that one should never be, but one could just as well say that it ruined Los Angeles too. The annexation of the San Fernando Valley, a direct result of the aqueduct, instantly made it the largest city in the world in geographic size. From that moment, it was doomed to become a huge, sprawling, one-story conurbation, hopelessly dependent on the automobile. The Owens River made Los Angeles large enough and wealthy enough to go out and capture any river within 600 miles, and that made it larger, wealthier, and a good deal more awful. It is the only megalopolis in North America which is mentioned in the same breath as Mexico City or Jakarta, a place whose insoluble excesses raise the specter of some majestic, stately kind of collapse. In The Water Seekers, Remy Nadeau, a city historian, says, "They brought in so much water for so many people that few cared any more whether Los Angeles grew at all. Indeed, one might say that they have brought in too much water. For if California now has enough water to more than double in population, then much of California is doomed to be insufferable." That, in any event, is the way it appears some days from atop Mulholland Drive. Chapter 3. First Causes. When archaeologists from some other planet sift through the bleached bones of our civilization, they may well conclude that our temples were dams. Imponderably massive, constructed with exquisite care, our dams will outlast anything else we have built: skyscrapers, cathedrals, bridges, even nuclear power plants. When forests push through the rotting streets of New York and the Empire State Building is a crumbling hulk, Hoover Dam will sit astride the Colorado River much as it does today, intact, formidable, serene. The permanence of our dams will merely impress the archaeologists. Their numbers will leave them in awe. In this century, something like 250,000 have been built in the United States alone. If you ignore the earthen plugs thrown across freshets and small creeks to water stock or raise bass, then 50,000 or so remain. These, in the lexicon of the civil engineer, are major works. Even most of the major works are less than awesome. Damming rivers like the Chepaug, the Verdigris, Pilarcitos Creek, Mossman's Brook, and the North Fork of the Jump. Forget about them, and you are left with a couple of thousand really big dams, the thought of whose construction staggers the imagination. They hold back rivers our ancestors thought could never be tamed: the Columbia, the Tennessee, the Sacramento, the Snake, the Savannah, the Red, the Colorado. They are 60 stories high, or 4 miles long. They contain enough concrete to pave an interstate highway from end to end. These are the dams that will make the archaeologists blink and wonder. Did we overreach ourselves trying to build them? Did our civilization fall apart when they silted up? Why did we feel compelled to build so many? Why 5 dozen on the Missouri and its major tributaries? Why 25 on the Tennessee? Why 14 on the Stanislaus River's short run from the Sierra Nevada to the sea? We know surprisingly little about vanished civilizations whose majesty and whose ultimate demise were closely linked to liberties they took with water. Unlike ourselves, future archaeologists will have the benefit of written records, of time capsules, and so forth. But such things are as apt to confuse as to enlighten. What, for example, will archaeologists make of congressional debates over Tellico Dam, where the vast majority ridiculed the dam, excoriated it, flagellated it, and then allowed it to be built? What will they think of congressmen voting for water projects like Central Arizona and Tennessee Tombigbee, projects costing $3 or $4 billion in an age of astronomical deficits, when Congress's own fact-finding committees asserted or implied that they made little sense? Such debates and documents may shed light on reasons, rational or otherwise, but they will be of little help in explaining the psychological imperative that drove us to build dam after dam after dam. If there is a Brodel or a Gibbon in the future, however, he may deduce that the historical foundations of dams as monumental as Grand Coulee, of projects as nonsensical as Tennessee Tombigbee, are sunk in the 1880s, a decade which brought in quick succession a terrible blizzard, a terrible drought, and a terrible flood. The Great White Winter of 1886 came first. The jet stream drove northward, grazed the Arctic Circle, then dipped sharply southward, a parabolic curve rushing frigid air into the plains. Through December of 1886, the temperature in South Dakota barely struggled above zero. A brief thaw intervened in January, followed by a succession of monstrous Arctic storms. Week after week, the temperature fell to bottomless depths. In the Dakotas, the wind chill factor approached 100 below. Trapped for weeks, even for months, in a warp of frozen treeless prairie, thousands of pioneers literally lost their minds. As the last of the chairs were being chopped and burned, settlers contemplated a desperate hike to the nearest town, unable to decide whether it was crazier to stay or to leave. No one knows how many lost their lives, but when the spring thaw finally came, whole families were discovered clutching their last potatoes or each other, ice encrusted on their staring, vacant eyes. But the settlers' suffering was merciful compared to that of their cows. On the woodless plains, barns were rare. Cattle were turned out into blizzards to survive by their wits, which they don't have, and which wouldn't have done them much good anyway. They were found piled by the hundreds at the corners of fenced quarter sections, all facing southeast. Even when a storm abated, the survivors were too traumatized to turn around, and they died a night or two later under a listless winter's moon. It was a winter not just of horrendous cold, but of gigantic snows, horizontal broadsides that reduced visibility to zero and stung the cattle like showers of needles. 20-foot drifts filled the valleys and swales, covering whatever frozen grass was left to eat. At night, families would lie awake, listening to their cows' dreadful bawls, afraid to go out and have the wind steal their last resources of warmth. Anyway, there was nothing they could do. The toll was never officially recorded. Most estimates put the loss of cattle at around 35%, but in some regions it may have been nearer 75%. In sheer numbers, enough cows died to feed the nation for a couple of years. Much of the plains cattle industry was in financial ruin. The bankrupt cattle barons dismissed thousands of hired hands who were forced to find new careers. When the snows of 1886 melted, Robert Leroy Parker, a young drover, cattle rustler, and part-time bank robber with a reputation, had more recruits on his hands than he knew what to do with. He organized them into a gang known as the Wild Bunch and called himself Butch Cassidy. The Wild Bunch and the scores of outlaw bands like them worked the banks, the railroads, and the Pinkerton agents into a murderous froth. To others, however, they were a moral weight on the mind. Many of the outlaws had been good boys, former ranch hands and farmers, occupations that everyone hoped would domesticate the West and cure it of its cyclical agonies of boom and bust. But weather was the ultimate arbiter in the American West. Unless there was some way to control it, or at least minimize its effects, a good third of the nation might remain uninhabitable forever. As if to confirm such a prophecy, the decade following the Great White Winter was a decade when the western half of the continent decided to dry up. Like most droughts, this one came gradually, building up force, nibbling away at the settlers' fortunes as inexorably as their cattle nibbled away the dying grass. The sun, to which the settlers had so recently offered prayerful thanks, turned into a despotic orb. As Hamlin Garland wrote, "The sky began to scare us with its light." In July of 1888, at Bennett, Colorado, the temperature rose to 118, a record that has never since been equaled in the state. It was the same throughout the West, as an immense high-pressure zone sat immobile across the plains. Orographic clouds promising rain formed over the Rockies were boiled off in midair and disappeared. The atmosphere, it seemed, had been permanently sucked dry. By 1890, the third year of the drought, it was obvious that the theory that rain follows the plow was a preposterous fraud. The people of the Plains States, still shell-shocked by the Great White Winter, began to turn back east. The populations of Kansas and Nebraska declined by between one quarter and one half. Tens of thousands went to the wetter Oklahoma Territory, which the federal government usurped from the five Indian tribes to whom it had been promised in perpetuity, and offered to anyone who got there first. Meanwhile, the windmills of the farmers who remained north were pumping up sand instead of water, and the huge dark clouds on the horizon were not rain, but dust. The great cattle freeze of the white winter had been, in retrospect, a blessing in disguise. Had several million more cows been around to graze the dying prairie grasses to their roots, the Dust Bowl of the 1930s could have arrived half a century early. When statistics were collected a few years later, only 400,000 homesteading families had managed to persevere on the plains, of more than a million who tried. The Homestead Acts had been a relative success in the East. West of the 100th Meridian, however, they were for the most part a failure, even a catastrophic failure. Much of the blame rested on flaws in the acts themselves and on the imperfections of human nature, but a lot of it was the fault of the weather. How could you settle a region where you nearly froze to death one year and expired from heat and lack of water during the next eight or nine? The drought that struck the West in the late 1880s did not occlude the entire continent. In the spring of 1889, the jet stream that had bypassed the West was feeding a thoroughfare of ocean moisture into the eastern states. In the mountains of Pennsylvania, it rained more or less continuously for weeks. The Allegheny and Susquehanna rivers became swollen surges of molten mud. Above Johnstown, Pennsylvania, on the south fork of the Connemara River, a tributary of the Allegheny, sat a big earth-filled dam built 37 years earlier by the Pennsylvania Canal Company. It was, for a while, the largest dam in the world. Pounded by the rains, infiltrated by the waters of the rising reservoir, the dam was quietly turning into cream of wheat. On May 31st, with a sudden flatulent shudder, it dissolved. 16 billion gallons of water dropped like a bomb on the town below. Before anyone had time to flee, Johnstown was swallowed by a 30-foot wave. When the reservoir was finally in the Allegheny River, sending it far over its banks, the town had disappeared. 400 corpses were never positively identified. The number of dead was eventually put at 2,200, twice as many casualties as in the burning of the General Slocum on the East River in 1904, many more than in the San Francisco earthquake and fire, nine times as many as in the Chicago fire. The only single disaster in American history that took more lives was the hurricane that struck Galveston, Texas, 11 years later. The Johnstown flood was significant if only for this sheer loss of life, but it was also an indictment of privately built dams. The rapid rise of the federal irrigation movement in the early 1890s was due in part to this succession of overawing catastrophes. But it had just as much to do with the fact that by the late 1880s, private irrigation efforts had come to an inglorious end. The good sites were simply gone. Most of the pioneers who had settled successfully across the 100th Meridian had gone to Washington and California and Oregon, where there was rain, or had chosen homesteads along streams whose water they could easily divert. Such opportunities, however, were quick to disappear. Groundwater wasn't much help either. A windmill could lift enough drinking water for a family and a few cattle, but it would require 30 or 40 windmills and reliable wind to lift enough water to irrigate a quarter section of land, a disheartening prospect to a farmer with no money in a region with no wood. Even if their land abutted a stream with some surplus water rights, few farmers had the confidence, cooperative spirit, and money to build the dam and lead the stored water to their lands through a long canal. It was one thing to throw a 10-foot-high earthen plug across a freshet in order to create a 2-acre stock pond, though even that taxed the resources of most farmers in the West, who had invested all their savings simply to get there from Kentucky or Maine. It was quite another thing to build a dam on a stream large enough to supply a year-round flow, and to dig a canal, by horse and by hand, that was long enough and deep enough and wide enough to irrigate hundreds or thousands of acres of land. The work involved was simply stupefying. Clearing a field, by comparison, seemed like the simplest, most effortless job. The farmer's predicament, on the other hand, was an opportunity for the legions of financial swashbucklers who had gone west in pursuit of quick wealth. In the 1870s and 1880s, hundreds of irrigation companies, formed with eastern capital, set themselves to the task of reclaiming the arid lands. Almost none survived beyond 10 years. At the 8th National Irrigation Congress in 1898, a Colorado legislator likened the American West to a graveyard, littered with the crushed and mangled skeletons of defunct irrigation corporations, which suddenly disappeared at the end of brief careers, leaving only a few defaulted obligations to indicate the route by which they departed. There was, indeed, a kind of cruel irony in the collapse of the irrigation companies. Most of them operated in the emphatically arid regions, the Central Valley of California, Nevada, Arizona, southeastern Colorado, New Mexico, where agriculture without irrigation is daunting or hopeless, but otherwise the climate is well suited for growing crops. The drought, on the other hand, struck hardest in the region just east of the 100th meridian, where in most years a non-irrigating farmer had been able to make a go of it. Kansas was emptied by the drought and the white winter, Nevada by irrigation companies gone defunct. In the early 1890s, the exodus from Nevada, as a percentage of those who hung on, was unlike anything in the country's history. Even California, in the midst of a big population boom, saw the growth of its agricultural population come to a standstill in 1895. California, the perennial trend-setting state, was the first to attempt to rescue its hapless farmers. But the result, the Right Act, was another in the long series of doomed efforts to apply eastern solutions to western topography and climate. The Act, which took its inspiration from the township governments of New England, established self-governing mini-states called irrigation districts, whose sole function was to deliver water onto barren land. Like the Western homestead laws, it was a good idea that foundered in practice. The districts soon buckled under their responsibilities, issuing bonds that wouldn't sell, building reservoirs that wouldn't fill, allocating water unfairly, distributing it unevenly, then throwing up their hands when anarchy prevailed. Elwood C. Meade, then the state engineer of Wyoming, and probably the country's leading authority on irrigation, called the Right Act a disgrace to any self-governing people. George Maxwell, a Californian founder of the National Irrigation Association, said the extravagance or stupidity or incompetence of local irrigation directors had left little beyond a legacy of waste and disaster. Though the Right Act was in most ways a failure, Colorado, thinking it had learned something from California's mistakes, adopted its own version, which added a modest subsidy for private irrigation developers in order to improve their odds of success. By 1894, under Colorado's new program, 5 substantial storage reservoirs had been built. 3 were so poorly designed and situated that they stored no water at all. The 4th was declared unsafe and was never even filled, and the 5th was so far from the land it was supposed to irrigate that most of the meager quantity of water it could deliver disappeared into the ground before it got there. In that same year, 1894, Senator Joseph Carey of Wyoming, thinking he had learned something from California's and Colorado's mistakes, introduced a bill that offered another approach. The federal government would cede up to 1 million acres of land to any state that promised to irrigate it. But, by some elusive reasoning, the states were forbidden to use land as the collateral they would need to raise the money to build the irrigation works. And land, at the time, was the only thing of value most of them had. 16 years later, using a generous estimate, the Carey Act had caused 288,553 acres to come under irrigation throughout the entire 17-state West, about as much developed farmland as there was in a couple of counties in Illinois. As the private and state-fostered experiments with irrigation lay in shambles, many of the Western reclamation advocates heaped blame on the East and Washington for not doing more to help, just as their descendants, four generations later, would vilify Jimmy Carter, an Easterner and Southerner, for not understanding their needs when he tried to eliminate some water projects that would have subsidized a few hundred of them to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars apiece. In each case, the West was displaying its peculiarly stubborn brand of hypocrisy and blindness. Midwestern members of Congress were understandably uneager to subsidize competition for their own former constituents, but they had little to do with making reclamation fail. The West was up to the task itself. Its faith in private enterprise was nearly as absolute as its earlier faith that settlement would make the climate wetter. John Wesley Powell, a Midwesterner, knew that all the private initiative in the world would never make it bloom. Theodore Roosevelt, an Easterner, had returned from the West convinced that there were vast areas of public land which can be made available for settlement, but only, he added, by building reservoirs and mainline canals impractical for private enterprise. But the West wasn't listening. For the first time in their history, Americans had come up against a problem they could not begin to master with traditional American solutions: private capital, individual initiative, hard work. And yet the region confronting the problem happened to believe most fervently in such solutions. Through the 1890s, Western senators and congressmen resisted all suggestions that reclamation was a task for government alone, not even for the states, which had failed as badly as the private companies, but for the national government. To believe such a thing was to imply that their constituents did not measure up to the myth that enshrouded them, that of the indomitable individualist. When they finally saw the light, however, their attitude miraculously changed, though the myth didn't, and the American West quietly became the first and most durable example of the modern welfare state. The passage of the Reclamation Act of 1902 was such a sharp left turn in the course of American politics that historians still gather and argue over why it was passed. To some, it was America's first flirtation with socialism, an outgrowth of the populist and progressive movements of the time. To others, it was a disguised reactionary measure, an effort to relieve the mobbed and riotous conditions of the eastern industrial cities, an act to save heartless capitalism from itself. To some, its roots were in Manifest Destiny, whose incantation still held people in their sway. To others, it was a military ploy to protect and populate America's western flank against the ascendant Orient. What seems beyond question is that the Reclamation Act, or some variation of it, was by the end of the 19th century inevitable. To resist a federal reclamation program was to block all further migration to the West, and to ensure disaster for those who were already there, or for those who were on their way. Even as the victims of the Great White Winter and the drought of the 1880s and 1890s were evacuating the arid regions, the trains departing Chicago and St. Louis for points west were full. The pull of the West reached deep into the squalid slums of the eastern cities. It reached back to the ravined, rock-strewn farms of New England and down into the boggy, overwet farmlands of the Deep South. No matter what the government did, short of erecting a wall at the 100th meridian, the settlement of the West was going to continue. The only way to prevent more cycles of disaster was to build a civilization based on irrigated farming. 50 years of effort by countless numbers of people had resulted in 3,631,000 acres under irrigation by 1889. There were counties in California that contained more acreage than that, and the figure included much of the easily irrigable land. Not only that, but at least half of the land had been irrigated by Mormons. Each additional acre, therefore, would be one at greater pain. Everything had been tried. Cheap land, free land, private initiative, local initiative, state subsidy, and everything, with a few notable exceptions, had failed. One alternative remained. There seemed to be only one politician in the arid West who fathomed his region's predicament well enough to end it. He had immigrated to San Francisco from the East, made a fortune through a busy law practice and the inheritance of his father-in-law's silver mine, moved to Nevada, and in 1888 launched the Truckee Irrigation Project. It was one of the most ambitious reclamation efforts of its day, and it failed. Not because it was poorly conceived or executed. Hydrologically and economically, it was a good project. But because squabbles among its beneficiaries and the pettiness of the Nevada legislature ruined its hopes. In the process, Francis Griffith Newlands lost $500,000 and whatever faith he had in the ability of private enterprise to mount a successful reclamation program. "Nevada," he said bitterly as his project went bust in 1891, "is a dying state." Newlands, who succeeded at everything else he tried, gave up on irrigation, ran for Congress, and won. For the remainder of the decade, he kept out of the reclamation battles, if only to give everyone else a solution an opportunity to fail. All the while, however, he was waiting for his moment. It came on September 14, 1901, when a bullet fired by an anarchist ended the life of President William McKinley. Theodore Roosevelt, the man who succeeded McKinley as president, was, like Francis Newlands, a student and admirer of John Wesley Powell. Infatuated with the West, he had traveled extensively there and been struck by the prescience and accuracy of Powell's observations. Roosevelt was first of all a politician, and had no interest in sharing Powell's ignominious fate. Nonetheless, he knew that Powell's solutions were the only ones that would work, and he wanted a federal reclamation effort badly. A military thinker, he was concerned about Japan, bristling with expansionism and dirt poor in resources, and knew that America was vulnerable on its underpopulated western flank. A bug for efficiency, he felt that the waste of money and effort on doomed irrigation ventures was a scandal. Roosevelt was also a conservationist, in the utilitarian sense, and the failure to conserve, that is, use, the water in western rivers irritated him. The western half of the United States would sustain a population greater than that of our whole country today if the waters that now run to waste were saved and used for irrigation, he said in a speech in December of 1901. For all his enthusiasm, however, Roosevelt knew that his biggest problem would not be the eastern states in Congress, but the myth-bound western bloc, whose region he was trying to help. His second greatest problem, ironically, would be his chief ally, Francis Newlands. As soon as Roosevelt was in the White House, Newlands introduced a bill creating a federal program along the lines suggested by Powell. But the bitterness he felt over his huge financial loss was so strong that he described his bill in language almost calculated to infuriate his Western colleagues, who were clinging to the myth that the hostile natural forces of the West could be overcome by individual initiative. In a long speech on the floor of Congress, Newlands said outright that the legislation he was introducing would nationalize the works of irrigation, which was like saying today that one intended to nationalize the automobile industry. Then he launched into a long harangue about the failures of the state reclamation programs, blaming them on the ignorance, the improvidence, and the dishonesty of local legislatures, even though many of his listeners had recently graduated from such legislatures themselves. He even suggested that Congress should have no oversight powers, implying that he distrusted that body as much as he did the thieves, opportunists, and incompetents whom he saw controlling the state legislatures. Newland's bill, as expected, ran into immediate opposition. When it came up for a vote in March, it was soundly defeated. Western members then began to support a rival bill, proposed by Senator Francis E. Warren of Wyoming, that contained none of the features Newlands wanted. By February of 1902, Warren's bill was finally passed by the Senate and seemed destined to become law. At that point, however, fate and Theodore Roosevelt intervened. Mrs. Warren became gravely ill, necessitating the senator's return to Wyoming. In Warren's absence, Roosevelt leaned on Newlands to tone down his language, and before long the congressman was describing his defeated measure, which he had already reintroduced, as a conservative and safe bill. Roosevelt still wouldn't risk supporting it, but he came up with a brilliant ploy. Announcing his sympathy with the spirit of Warren's bill, he said he would support it with a few minor changes. The person whom he wanted to make the changes and lead the bill through Congress was Wyoming's young congressman-at-large, Frank Mondell, the future Republican leader of the House. Mondell had a weakness for flattery and a less-than-athletic mind, and Roosevelt was a master at exploiting both. Before long, he had persuaded Mondell to incorporate as minor changes in Warren's bill almost all of Newland's language. Roosevelt then softened up his eastern opposition with some implied threats that their river and harbor projects might be in jeopardy if they did not go along, a strategy that has seen long, useful service. By the time Warren returned from Wyoming, Newland's bill, disguised as his own, had cleared both houses. On June 17, 1902, the Reclamation Act became law. The newly created Reclamation Service exerted a magnetic pull on the best engineering graduates in the country. The prospect of reclaiming a desert seemed infinitely more satisfying than designing a steel mill in Gary, Indiana, or a power dam in Massachusetts, and the graduates headed west in a fog of idealism, ready to take on the most intractable foe of mankind, the desert. But the desert suffers improvement at a steep price, and the early reclamation program was as much a disaster as its dams were engineering marvels. The underlying problems were politics and money. Under the terms of the Reclamation Act, projects were to be financed by a reclamation fund, which would be filled initially by revenues from sales of federal lands in the western states, then paid back gradually through sales of water to farmers. It should be mentioned right away that the farmers, under the law, were exempted from paying interest on virtually all of their repayment obligations, a subsidy which was substantial to begin with, and which was to become breathtaking in later decades, as interest rates topped 10%. In some cases, the interest exemption alone, which is, of course, an indirect burden on the general taxpayer, has amounted to a subsidy of 90 cents on the dollar. Section 9 of the Reclamation Act implied, if it didn't require, that all money accruing to the Reclamation Fund from sales of land in any given state should be spent in that state as well. Frederick Newell, the service's first director, was particularly anxious to locate a few projects in each state anyway, because that might dispel some of the antipathy that had attended the service's creation. By 1924, 27 projects were completed or under construction. Of those, 21 had been initiated before the service was even half a decade old. The engineers who staffed the Reclamation Service tended to view themselves as a godlike class, performing hydrologic miracles for grateful simpletons who were content to sit in the desert and raise fruit. About soil science, agricultural economics, or drainage, they sometimes knew less than the farmers whom they regarded with indulgent contempt. As a result, some of the early projects were to become painful embarrassments and expensive ones. The soil turned out to be demineralized, alkaline, boron-poisoned. Drainage was so poor The irrigation water turned fields into saline swamps. Markets for the crops didn't exist. Expensive projects with heavy repayment obligations were built in regions where only low-value crops could be grown. In the Bureau of Reclamation's quasi-official history, Water for the West, Michael Robinson, the son-in-law of a commissioner of reclamation, discreetly admits all of this. Initially, little consideration was given to the hard realities of irrigated agriculture. Neither aid nor direction was given to settlers in carrying out the difficult and costly work of clearing and leveling the land, digging irrigation ditches, building roads and houses, and transporting crops to remote markets. Robinson also acknowledges the political pressures that have bedeviled the reclamation program ever since it was born. The attitude of most Western members of Congress was quaintly hypocritical. After resisting this experiment in pseudo-socialism, or even voting against it, they decided, after it became law, that they might as well make the best of it. The government was immediately flooded with requests for project investigations, Robinson writes. Local chambers of commerce, real estate interests, and congressmen were convinced their areas were ideal for reclamation development. State legislators and officials joined the chorus of promoters seeking reclamation projects. Legislative requirements and political pressures sometimes precluded careful, exhaustive surveys of proposed projects. Projects were frequently undertaken with only a sketchy understanding of the area's climate, growing season, soil productivity, and market conditions. Congress's decision, in passing the act, to ignore much of John Wesley Powell's advice made things worse. Powell had proposed that in those inhospitable regions where only livestock could be raised, settlers should be allowed to homestead 2,560 acres of the public domain, but allocated enough water to irrigate only 20. The Reclamation Act gave everyone up to 160 acres. A man and wife could jointly farm 320 acres. Whether they settled in Mediterranean California or in the frigid interior steppes of Wyoming, where the extremes of climate rival those in Mongolia. You could grow wealthy on 160 acres of lemons in California and starve on 160 acres of irrigated pasture in Wyoming or Montana, but the act was blind to such nuances. And by building so many projects in a rush, the Reclamation Service was repeating its mistakes before it had a chance to learn from them. All of these problems were compounded by the fact that few settlers had any experience with irrigation farming, nor were they required to. They overwatered and mismanaged their crops. They let their irrigation systems silt up. Many had optimistically filed on more acreage than they had resources to irrigate, and they ended up with repayment obligations on land they were forced to leave fallow. From there, it was a short, swift fall into bankruptcy. 50 years earlier, the ancestors of the first reclamation farmers had endured adversity by putting their faith in God and feeding themselves on game. But this was the 20th century. The game was vanishing, and government was replacing God as the rescuer of last resort. As Michael Robinson wrote, Western economic and social determinants were changing rapidly. 19th-century irrigation pioneers were better suited to endure hardships than settlers who struggled to survive on federal reclamation projects after 1902. In the 19th century, wild game was plentiful, livestock could graze on the public domain outside irrigated areas, and the settlers were inured to privation. And so, after a few years of trial and a lot of error, the Reclamation Act began to undergo a long and remarkable series of reforms. The first was humble. A $20 million loan from the Treasury to the bankrupt Reclamation Fund to keep the program from falling on its face. It was approved in 1910, the same year that Section 9, the ill-advised clause promoting the construction of projects where they couldn't work, was repealed. New projects were also required to have the explicit consent of the president before they were launched. A paper reform, however, is not necessarily a reform in real life. Every senator still wanted a project in his state. Every congressman wanted one in his district. They didn't care whether they made economic sense or not. The Commissioner of Reclamation and the President were only human. If Congress authorized a bad project and voted funding for it, a president might have good reasons not to veto the bill, especially if it also authorized a lot of things the president did want. Congress caught on quickly and was soon writing omnibus authorization bills in which bad projects were thrown in willy-nilly with good ones. Later, Congress would learn a new trick, attaching sneaky little amendments authorizing particularly wretched projects to legislation dealing with issues such as education and hurricane relief. As a result, instead of weeding out or discouraging bad projects, the reforms began to concentrate on making bad projects work, or to put it more bluntly, on bailing them out. The first of these adjustments came in 1914, when the repayment period, which had been set in the Act at a rather unrealistic 10 years, was extended to 20. It was quite a liberal adjustment, but failed to produce any measurable results. By 1922, 20 years after the Reclamation Fund began, only 10% of the money loaned from the Reclamation Fund had been repaid. 60% of the irrigators, an astounding number, were defaulting on their repayment obligations, even though they paid no interest on irrigation features. In 1924, Congress commissioned a fact-finder's report on the reclamation program, which recommended an even more drastic adjustment, raising the repayment period from 20 years to 40. No sooner was that done, however, than the most chronic and intractable problem of 20th century American agriculture began to appear: huge crop surpluses. Production and prices reached record levels during the First World War. When the war ended, production remained high, but crop prices did not. The value of all crops grown on reclamation land fell from $152 million in 1919 to $83.6 million in 1922, as morose a statistic as the number of farmers in default. With their profits shriveling, the beleaguered farmers were reluctant to pay for water they were beginning to regard as rightful recompense for attempting to civilize the desert, especially when the Reclamation Service, in most cases, didn't dare shut it off when they refused to pay. So Congress took further steps to bail the reclamation program out, rerouting royalties from oil drilling and potassium mining to the Reclamation Fund on the theory that the West, while being stripped of its mineral resources, ought to get something in return. But even after all these measures had been adopted, a number of projects continued to operate at a hopeless loss. Nonetheless, the psychic value of the reclamation farms remained high. The only relief in a pitiless desert landscape, their worth was computed in almost ethereal terms, as if they were art. And their investment value to speculators remained high, too. An acre which in pre-project years was worth $5 or $10, if that, was suddenly worth 50 times as much. At such prices, many farmers found the temptation to sell out irresistible. By 1927, at least a third of the reclamation farmers had. The buyers were usually wealthy speculators who figured they could absorb some minor losses for a while, especially if they could convince Congress to give them tax breaks, as long as they could make money when agricultural prices went back up. The Salt River Project in Arizona was notable for having been all but taken over by speculators. Elwood Mead, who succeeded Newell and Arthur Powell Davis as Commissioner of Reclamation, called speculation a vampire which has done much to destroy the desirable social and economic purposes of the Reclamation Act. But the big distant new owners were often better at paying their water bills than the stone-broke small farmers, so the Reclamation Service, in a number of instances, turned a blind eye toward what was going on. It was a case of lawlessness becoming de facto policy, and it was to become more and more commonplace. Part of the reason the Reclamation Service, which metamorphosed fittingly into the Bureau of Reclamation in 1923, seemed so hapless at enforcing its social mandate had to do with the Omnibus Adjustment Act of 1926, one of those well-meaning pieces of legislation that make everything worse. Intended to clamp down on speculation, the act demanded that landowners